Good morrow, and welcome to the realm. I am epic fantasy author J.V. Hilliard, your friendly neighborhood scribe, and for those marking their first adventure into the realm, this is my vast and sweeping domain where I feature a variety of creatives on a weekly basis. You've heard many of them. I've had artists, I've had cinematographers, I've had authors, and tonight I've got a poet for you. So as always, if you like what you hear, you can find me on my epic and dark fantasy books at jvhilliard.com. Or follow me at JV Hilliard Books on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, or YouTube. Or look for me as well as just JV Hilliard on Facebook and Discord. So as we reach our witching hour, let me cast my message spell here and take control over the magical airways of Blog Talk Radio. And for you Dungeons & Dragons nerds out there like me, the duration of my spell typically lasts about 30 minutes. So set your sundials and let's get into the realm together. Today, we'll be chronicling the adventures of John C. Mannoni, an award-winning speculative poet, and I've had the pleasure of publishing his work at Altered Reality Magazine for the last year. John, welcome to the realm.
Hey, thank you, Joe. I appreciate your inviting me here, and it's going to be fun.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Tell our listeners about yourself a little bit, what kind of speculative poetry you write, and where they can find you.
Oh, yeah, sure. I write all kinds of literary quality speculative work. And by that, I mean, you know, stuff that has something to say that people can latch on to, not just horror for the sake of horror, or it may be other topics, other types of writing. It doesn't have to be horror. It can be, you know, fantasy or science fiction. I can be found by an easy Google of spelling of my last name is M-A-N-N-O-N-E, John C. If you Google me, you'll find me. You'll see that I have a WordPress page. I'm on Facebook, pretty friendly. So if you want to reach out to me there, that's fine. And my email is jcmannoni, M-A-N-N-O-N-E, @gmail.com.
Great. Well, look, well, let's get right into it. I mean, most folks know what speculative fiction is, but you're a speculative poet, and that might be new for some of our listeners. Tell everyone a bit about your genre and why you chose to write in it.
Well, that's a good question, Joe. I asked myself that question more than once. and it may sound a little arrogant, I don't mean to be, but when I first started writing seriously in 2004, I approached two areas that I thought were deficient. Now, here I am, a baby myself in writing, but I just had a sense that what I was reading, what was out there, I just didn't much care for. And there were two areas. One is Christian poetry, and the other is the speculative fiction era genre. I thought that members of both those groups could do a whole lot better than what I had read. Now, maybe I didn't read the right stuff or enough, and maybe I'm way off base. But anyway, that's what drove me to pick those particular genres at first. And some of it was a little bit accidental also, because when I started writing, I joined a Zoetrope, which used to be a very vibrant virtual studio that was run by the famous movie director Francis Coppola. And so I had a chance to meet a lot of other writers, excuse me, back then, and a lot of the interaction just happened to be in the speculative arena. So I liked it. I always liked it. And so that's kind of like how it started. I started seriously with poetry in 04, and then I was insecure in my genre, my literary genre, in this case, poetry versus prose. That I was afraid to approach fiction, let alone creative nonfiction. I thought it would compromise my poetry, which of course is nonsense, but that's the way I felt because I was immature in my craft. So I didn't start writing fiction until 2008. So my fiction lags, and my prose in general lags my poetry by 4 years.
Well, you know, it's funny because in some senses, you and I have really divergent backgrounds from what folks might think that we do. In your professional life, I know you're a professor. You've also done some work as an ambassador of sorts to NASA and the Jet Propulsion Lab. I mean, you're a guy that, just like me, I do defense and tech lobbying, you know, as my day job. And when people hear that I write epic fantasy, when they hear I'm a writer, they just assume I write, you know, nonfiction or historical fiction. And when I tell them, no, I write this real Dungeons and Dragons-y, Lord of the Rings stuff, they don't see the right brain, left brain thing. You know, and I think in your case, too, do you ever experience, like, people looking at you strange when you tell them that, you know, because they expect you to be one thing in your day job, and then, you know, your outlet is your poetry, and you tell them what you do, and do they look at you cross-eyed? Like, I get that sometimes, and they're like, what? You're doing what? You know, you get the same thing on your end?
Oh, yeah, all the time. The idea of using both sides of our brain, I feel very blessed. Like, women in general, just by nature, use both sides of their brain. That's a proven medical fact, where guys are traditionally left-brained. And I am so blessed to be able to use both sides of my brain, so I can get off on writing mathematical equations. It's almost orgasmic, and because I think the equations are another form of poetry. And and interestingly enough, all of my physics, I'm a chemist and a physicist. All of my physics and my science in general has even informed my poetry. The logicalness of that left brain, it comes really handy in the revision process. And poetry gives something back to physics that's really incredible. It reminds me of about thinking outside the box. And like Einstein said, that behind every successful scientist is not only a great woman. I don't know if he said that or not, but the thing is that all the great thinkers were out of the box thinkers, and like he himself. Not that I'm an Einstein or anything like that. I'm no dummy for sure, but I just want to make the point that poetry taught me to re-examine my science with this out-of-the-box attitude. And so it's helped me understand some things and even postulate some physics that, who knows, I've documented it in the form of poetry, so that way, posthumously, maybe I can become famous or something, but I'm just jesting.
Well, hey, you know, that's funny you mentioned that, because my follow-up question to you was going to be halfway through your answer was, has your day job ever manifested itself in your poetry? But you almost described it in the inverse, which was, you know, has your poetry manifested in your day job? I'm curious to see if there's stuff that you're working on that you end up writing poetry about. And you flipped the script on me there. So talk about that a little bit. Has it ever happened where something you're working on has become a poem or a set of poems for you?
Yeah, I'll give you a specific example. The black hole, as we understand it, is this an enigma in physics, because it has the equations tend to generate or tend to show us that there's a singularity at the bottom of the black hole. Mother Nature, and I say that tongue in cheek, because I know it's not Mother Nature, but we'll just personify whatever belief system you want by calling her Mother Nature, doesn't like discontinuities, doesn't like these singularities. It's something else has to be there. And so I imagine that since, for example, energy and matter are linked at the hip, that Einstein's formula E equals MC squared is it's exactly that statement of energy and mass are basically equivalent. They only differ by proportionality constant. Well, time and space are also linked together. The mathematician Minkowski showed that you can treat time as an imaginary spatial coordinate. So here we have energy and mass in one hand, time and space in another hand, and I just ponder, put them all together. Maybe there's this hyper entity or particle of sorts that is degenerate in matter, energy, time, and space, and maybe that's kind of wild speculation. Of course, one would need a lot more mathematics, and I'm not certain even the mathematics that we need for that even exists yet, but it's getting there. That's one example.
I was going to say, I think there is something poetic, and I use that tongue in cheek about the fact that you can use, you know, this in your day job to explain something to a classroom full of folks that are trying to learn something, and or you can invert it and use it as an art form and talk about, like you described, equations being an art form, and there's something eloquent about them. And, you know, I think part of that is because equations are exactly that. It defines something. And, you know, and when you're writing poetry, you know, I think you have a chance to define it in the form of a story as opposed to maybe a mathematical equation. But I know on many shows like this, poets often have a chance to read something from their portfolio. So I'm going to ask you to do the same. I think our listeners would love to hear a poem of yours. You know, when you're ready, I'd love for you to just kind of fire away from it, and then we could talk about that in particular.
Oh, okay. I had picked something in the horror end of things because, I don't know, I guess because I was thinking horror was on my mind, maybe because I'm being interviewed tomorrow by the Horror Writers Association. The idea of horror being a genre, I guess it's a genre of sorts. The certain kinds of genres, certain kinds of horror, like the slashers and this and that. I think of horror more as a mood or a tone that's not just for the horror genre, but any genre you can think of, including literary. And I don't like those distinctions, but the world has kind of like stuck us with them. So in writing horror, the thing that I want to do is to do what the movie does. You got visuals, you got sound. Imagine real quick before I read the Psycho scene by Alfred Hitchcock, a great influencer of my work together with Stephen King. When the killer you see, you never see the faces, or you don't see the murder happening, but you see the blood running down the drain. And what's happened musically is that the violins are undergoing this sforzando, this tearing, a typical horror. How do you capture something like that in words alone? And yet, so anyway, I try to build up tension as much as I can, and here is a poem that's inspired by something in the Bible. Actually, it turns out that a book of a lot of great ideas in there for horror. I'm telling you. Okay, here we go. This is called Influx.
Yeah, fire away, my friend.
And it's a Halloween poem, as you can see, as you will see. Influx. It was before death rode in, headless on a pale horse. Before the day of the Triffids, before the Druids, black witches, and warlocks, before the chariots of alien gods haunted the late October air when even the moon howled. It was when the stars fell from heaven, but I fell on my knees and prayed as the gold bright streaks of light transformed to handsome men. I knew them from a vision I had dreamed. At night, they whisk into innocent ears of women, the daughters from all generations, sumptuous and pure. They swooned to smooth deception, fell to trickery of seduction. Soon delirium infested the women, and their unholy children ruled the earth. Mighty men, infamous, they were giants, grotesque as their own hearts. The Goliaths succumbed the men too, infected them with hatred and lies, so they too would bludgeon men, rip out their hearts. Then they'd be eating and drinking their blood. When the women saw the abominations they gave birth to, they ran screaming, but the fallen angels, the Nephilim, caught them anyway and took them into marriage, raping them again and again. I saw them do unspeakable things to serpents and lizards too. They made another breed of monsters that slithered the land. Then I heard the shriek of birds, and the eagles would be no more. Only the foul flying things from bestiality remained, swooping down, clawed the innocent and ate them like mice. Nothing but wicked creatures zombied all the land and skies. They only came out at night, for all were children of the dark, the Geber giants, the beasts of the field, the dragons of the air. All were no longer good as created, but changed. Only a few humans who had hid in the desert remained uninfected. They worked only by day, making the necessary preparations. I had whispered them to him in his dreams. I had whispered to Noah exactly what to do.
Yeah, that is a heavy poem, man. That first of all, you nailed it. It is scary. It is very, welcome to Halloween-ish kind of stuff. Clearly, there's biblical connections there. What was the inspiration behind that, man? Where did that come from? That's a deep. There are so many different lines in there. Like when you called it zombied, and you use zombied as a verb. I love that. But yeah, please, go ahead and tell everybody where the inspiration for that came from.
When I have questions, when I read the scriptures, and something doesn't seem to make sense to me, I try to make sense out of it. I go into the Hebrew, not that I can read it, but I'm intelligent enough to recognize the characters and what might or may not be there. And it was Genesis 6 when there were these giants in the land that, and people will debate, they still are debating whether it was, these descendants of Cain married the pure daughters of Adam or were they fallen angels who infected the women, and so there's a lot of that. So I took that idea, but the line that really bugged me was, and it's a paraphrase. He said, God regretted. God regretted creating man. And that didn't make any sense to me, because just a few chapters earlier, he's saying how good that creation was. So certainly that doesn't make any sense. So the Hebrew, what I know about Hebrew is that they have a grammatical construction called a particle, which is not translated. It goes right in front of the article. If it's there, then the noun, like ha Adam, the man or mankind, if it has this particle like eif, which is the way you pronounce it, then that gives very direct specificity to this man or mankind. And in this case, the context of Genesis 6 was these giants in the land. It was these particular men that God had regretted, that he allowed. And so now everything started to make sense. And says, well, yeah, it says, well, but what about what about all the animals on the land? What's the deal with them? I mean, they're innocent, aren't they? Or are they? So I started to imagine what would it be to make this good creation something terribly unacceptable. And I figured, well, not only did man become corrupt, so did the animals, and so therefore the bestiality reference was there. It's really out there. I don't teach the stuff; it's theology, but it's just an excellent opportunity to do poetry or story.
Yeah, I'm telling you, man, there was some deep stuff. The bestiality play, the idea of sort of like the lizards and reptiles, the line about eating them like mice almost gives sort of like a cat-like predatorial sort of, you know, and or again, you know, what else eats mice but snakes? And you hit on the reptile theme. You know, it was, and as far as like a horror poem, it's exactly, it evokes the feelings that you want it to evoke while telling the story, right? And I think that's just, it was fantastic. I'm glad you chose that poem. That's stick on the wall somewhere, and read it when you want to scare yourself.
Right.
Well, hey, just a couple of more questions. So my listeners are mostly readers. Some of them are authors too. And so they drop me questions from time to time for my guests, and I'm just going to ask you a few of them before we get into our lightning round here in a minute or two. So I know that you are an award-winning poet, so I'm not going to ask you about the best compliment you've gotten on your poetry. Instead, what was the toughest criticism you've received as a poet, and how did you deal with that?
The toughest criticism comes from myself. And I think most writers will
exactly.
agree, will relate to that. We are our own selves worst. We are our own worst critics. And you know, even today, with well over 1,000 pieces published, I still question my effectiveness. I says, I'm never going to be a household name, but that's okay. But you know, from an outside source, I guess. I don't remember right now. Usually editors don't give you that kind of criticism. They keep away from even giving you good remarks because it sometimes eggs people on to continue the conversation where really the editor may not want to, almost afraid to give information, constructive feedback, because some people are really negative about it, sadly. That's what I hear from a lot of other editors. Fortunately, I haven't had too much of that in my editing days, which is still our editing. I'm just editing two journals instead of four. Yeah, I've cut back. I had to. My aging years, and I'm still doing. I'm not retired anymore. I'm working now full time. So. I don't have the time to do what I like to do. I'm doing what I like to do. It's just a matter of, you know, making choices. I think it's easier to answer the first question that what was the best compliment I got from my poetry. One of them was this innocent person. He didn't really know that much, but he gave me, I felt, one of the greatest compliments. I was reading a rare rhyming. I don't write that much rhyming poems, but I do write them with. And I don't do end stop lines, at least not many of them, and I use slant rhymes. So to the ear, it sounds like one continuous natural flow, and not that sing songy stuff. Anyway, he said to me, "I didn't know that was a rhyming poem. That is the best compliment I could have gotten for writing a rhyming poem, because you don't realize until you look at it on the page that it was that." Subtle and effective. That I like very much.
Well, that's well played. Yeah. I can see. Look, I am not a poet. I'm far from it. But I get the sing-songy thing, or the seesaw side, where you're writing and all of a sudden you read five lines, and all of them seem to have gone. Like, you don't know you're doing it while you're doing it. When you go through the editing process, you're like, yeah, I got to break that up. You know, there's something there. So, but that, look, hey, you know, that is a good compliment, especially. When you could sneak it by somebody, it's like a curveball. They didn't see it coming, and they're like, "Wait a minute, You know, that crossed the plate as a strike. Yeah, right. Well, hey, look, we're coming to the end of our time. I do this with every one of our guests. We enter into a lightning round. So I'm going to ask you a bunch of questions. You know, feel free to answer them as quick as you can. But also, if you answer it, you know, and it's curious to me, I'm going to stop. We're going to go into it a little bit here. But we got a few more minutes to go. So I'm going to throw these at you one at a time. We'll see where it lands.
Okay.
Are you ready? All right, first one. I'll start you off with something easy. Your favorite poet of all time, dead or alive, and it can't be you.
Of course not. I can tell you that Henry Wadsworth Longfellow has been extremely influential in my career, so I respect that man enormously, even though my style is completely different.
So we'll log one on there for Longfellow then. All right, so as a scientist, as a guy who studies astronomy, I've got to ask this question, or else I'll never hear about it from my listeners. Star Trek or Star Wars?
Star Trek.
All right. Okay.
Especially
that's
the next generation.
Next Generation. Well, I'm glad you mentioned that because my very next question has to deal with Star Trek Next Generation, and I'm glad you went down that road. So you're on the holodeck on the Starship Enterprise. And you have a chance to insert yourself into any speculative fiction scene in any book or poem that you've ever read. What would it be and why?
Oh, wow. I remember being terribly impacted by two pieces. I weigh them equally. I forgot the name of the author, but the name of the novel was A Level 7. The irony of people dying, they survived a world war, a nuclear war, and yet a malfunctioning nuclear reactor at the seventh level of this refuge place ended up killing everybody from radiation poisoning. The irony there, because I'm very much now involved with nuclear stuff, I wonder if there's anything that I could have done to prevent that malfunction from happening, and that's the one. And the other one was
play it out on the holodeck there with your level 7. That's a good one. Yeah, I've got one more question before we have to wrap it up. So,
okay.
If you had to write under a pen name, what would it be?
It would only be my first name would be changed. It would be Giovanni Manoni. Because the poetic sound, my father was really born that way. But when he came to Ellis Island, they called him John. So I was born John Manoni. I should have been born Giovanni Manoni. So
my wife, whose last name is Michelucci, she would definitely like to hear that. So that's a great way to end this. John, it's been a real pleasure, but we are coming to the end of my duration magic here. And so as I feel the magic fading from my eyes, before I leave, I want to thank you again for allowing me to conjure you into my realm, if it was only for just a short time. And before you go, tell everyone where they can find you and your work one more time.
Oh, great. Yeah, just Google my name. You'll see me all over the place. But also WordPress has me. Just be sure you just put the J.C. Manoni or John C. Manoni, and then that'll bring it. You'll find me. And I'm on Facebook, so I'm pretty friendly there. I talk a lot about food and about writing, so I don't do politics or religion. You bet.
Yeah, thanks again for being on here. And just as a reminder, do not – Google Giovanni. You should Google John C. And to our followers out there, thanks again for lending us your ear tonight. And until next time, I am JV Hilliard, and may your gods go with you.